I really don't want to waste your time. Do you have any idea where Alex might be staying?
He and I don't speak.
Do you at least know if he's still in the country? If you had to find him...
Have you heard a thing I've said?
Paige snapped. In response, Hazel stood abruptly, not caring to hide her frustration.
Thank you for the tea.
But after returning her cup to the tray, curiosity won over, and she glanced back at the binders. Where are K through Z?
Paige tapped her forehead.
Up here. When it's complete, the Book of Probabilities will clock in at around 565 volumes.
You have a ways to go, then. Her aunt smiled, almost sadly.
I have a secret for you. It will never be finished. I will die before I ever get near Z.
If you can't finish it, why write it?
Paige readjusted her toadstool mass.
Because what else is there to do but work on what one is good at?
Hazel wondered how her aunt was making any money on this, but wasn't about to ask. Besides, Hazel knew something about living your life with complete disregard for profits. At least her aunt had something to show for it.
You know, Paige wagged an arthritic finger at Hazel. Your generation could stand to live in the pursuit a bit more. You're all rushed to get to the end, to succeed.
Alex is the same. He can see only the end result and is totally incapable of appreciating mathematics for its own sake.
If there is no tangible reward at the end, he sees the work as pointless.
It's an empty way to live, in constant pursuit of the trophy.
It's the reason he has failed.
Well, he's still young, Hazel said lamely, more in defense of herself than of Alex.
His probability of succeeding as a pure mathematician drops precipitously with each passing year, and his chances of succeeding at applied mathematics aren't much better. Plus he has a lazy brain.
I thought he had an accident.
Right. His so-called brain damage from that Autobahn incident? Horseshit. The real story of his failure is far more spectacular.
When Hazel didn't respond, Paige said,
Don't pretend like you don't want to know.
Hazel sat down again while her aunt dumped more sugar in her tea.
There is a group of 23 problems in mathematics called Hilbert's problems. Intellectual puzzles more than anything, though mathematicians take them very seriously. Most have been solved, but there are a few remaining. One particularly stubborn problem was solved by my son many years ago while he was at the Max Planck Institute.
Paige looked up to measure her guest's reaction.
Wondering why you haven't heard about such a triumph? Why Isaac never mentioned it?
Hazel nodded.
You've never heard about it because someone else beat my son to the proof. By a couple of weeks.
Paige appeared amused by this.
An unassuming Russian who'd been working in his mother's basement for years quietly published his proof. No fanfare, just mailed it off. And in our world, publishing is everything.
Hazel assigned this new information to her previous image of Alex. Now that she thought about it, beneath all the bluster, there had been an air of defeat about him. But that's not his fault, she said.
It's just bad luck.
Paige smiled.
Maybe. But it's what he did afterward that revealed his true character. He did nothing. Zero. Completely gave up mathematics. He blamed it all on this supposed car wreck, of course. But I knew.
Is that why you don't speak to him?
She shrugged. He doesn't speak to me because he knows I disapprove of his vagrant lifestyle. Bumming around Paris, going to parties, sleeping around. God knows what else. How he affords all this laziness, don't ask me.
Maybe he has another source of income? Hazel suggested pointedly.
Well, obviously. Though I don't buy this AP photographer nonsense.
Paige snorted and swiveled back to her desk.
Now you'll really have to excuse me. I'm attacking a particularly difficult section on the odds of succeeding as a jazz musician.
Hazel stood up, unsure how to transition out of the room. I'll find my own way out.
Wait!
Paige practically shouted. Hazel paused at the door.
I made an agreement with myself long ago that I would leave the warmth to warm people. But tell them that I'd let you in, won't you? That I didn't turn a relative away. No one in this family gives me any credit.
I will, Hazel said, suddenly overcome with sadness for this aunt she had never liked. She started down the hall, glancing back just as Paige splashed something from a bottle into her teacup. When she reached the front door, she could hear her aunt muttering something to her dogs. Outside, Hazel closed the gate to the yard, and, for lack of a better idea, turned in the direction of the beach, guided by the light of the surrounding bungalows. After removing her shoes and socks at the edge of the concrete, she stepped onto the cool sand and kept walking. When she reached the shoreline, she let the incoming tide engulf her feet. How long had it been since she'd touched the Pacific? Living on Puget Sound for so many years, surrounded by water on all sides, it was easy to lose track of the last time you set eyes on the actual ocean. It was easy to forget how this boundless expanse seemed to exist for moments like this, when you are rigidly stuck, with nowhere left to go. Hazel closed her eyes. In a very literal interpretation of Raspanti's doomsday prediction, she imagined herself opening her laptop one morning, clicking through her usual news sites, and finding variations on the same headline, her mistake writ large. Powerful people do irretrievably terrible thing. Had she really inflicted such a grave injury onto the future? Was her mistake irreversible? She stepped backward and collapsed onto dry sand. Below the crash of the surf, she could just make out an alien sound, a pinging coming from her purse. She fished out her phone and discovered she had a text from Bennett. She considered deleting it, but didn't have the willpower not to read it first. H. Hope you can make the opening. X. B. She clicked on the attached link, and up popped a website for a Seattle art gallery. Bennett's show, the one he had been working on for years, had arrived. New exhibition. Bennett Hughes. This is my sad face. The shock of human emotion. Below it, a mixed-media likeness of her own face stared out at the viewer with a flash of irritation. The photo underlying the image had been taken near the beginning of her relationship with Bennett, the light of a setting sun glancing off one cheek. But the details of her skin were gone, smeared over with paint, wax, and paper. It wasn't a bad piece, and she knew this exhibition was a big deal for him, but she could only bring herself to reply, "Nice title." He must have taken some perverse pleasure in naming his show after her last message to him. Hazel scrolled up until her previous text and accompanying selfie filled the screen. "This is my sad face." She could hardly stand to look at it and was about to tuck away her phone when she noticed something about the image. Behind her unhappy head was a fragment of Isaac's map, evidently the single shot of the map that had escaped erasure. She zoomed in on it, and to her astonishment, the resolution was sharp all the way in. Having spent little time exploring her own phone, she was still mystified by its capabilities. Hazel pulled in close enough to make out the names of downtown streets and to read the dots Isaac had placed there. There were a few dots sitting in a cluster, one reading 10-15-15-01-31-22. Or October 15th, 2015, 1:31 a.m. and 22 seconds. If the dot was accurate, just a month ago near the corner of Maple Avenue and East 6th Street, some poor soul had breathed his or her last. But then that was to be expected on Skid Row. A couple of blocks away were two more dots, near the Historic District, where two people had apparently died in August within minutes of each other. "Your grandfather wasn't predicting just any kind of death," she remembered Raspanti saying. "Okay, if not just death, then what?" "You know what." She shut her eyes tight. When she opened them again, they settled on a single red circle, near the intersection of Alameda Street and the 101 freeway, the location of Union Station. She read the numbers, 11-15-15. November 15th. Today. The rest of the string read, 212506. That was tonight. Hazel couldn't know where Alex would be or what he would do next. But if she had been the one to steal Isaac's equation, she would certainly want to see if the thing worked. Tonight, at 9:25 and 6 seconds, something was going to happen at Union Station. That gave her less than 2 hours. Chapter 22. The Equation. As Philip headed up the coast toward Malibu, he realized he would have to navigate from the unreliable memory of having been driven there weeks before. He wondered if he should have called ahead to warn Nellie, or had her send the car, but he was done with formalities. Besides, if he had to flee from her a second time, he wanted a getaway vehicle. Philip had left the house in a gust of unspecified urgency and with a quick kiss to Jane, who had been keeping herself busy in the kitchen with clippers and an ailing plant. She hadn't even looked up, tending to the leaves with obsessive focus. He found himself disappointed that she hadn't asked where he was going. A simple, "Where are you off to?" And he pictured himself falling to the floor at Jane's garden-clogged feet and unloading it all. Not just about GSR and Nellie, but also about his inability to work, about how he missed his father horribly, as much as he missed their daughter, in fact. He would have even confessed his betrayal of their marriage, and how this young, oddball physicist at the dawn of her career made him feel confused. It would have been an ugly confession, and he would have deserved a prompt clog to the face. It was well into the afternoon when he parked. The house stood boxy and graphic against the sky, looking more unreal than it had the first time. Philip headed up the walk and rang the bell. A man with a trim beard, around his own age, answered. He was tall, spectacled, and indifferently dressed, wearing untucked shirt sleeves and dress socks minus the shoes. It was the same man he had seen through the ground floor window on his first visit.
"How can I help you?" the man asked in a watery English accent.
"I'm Philip Severy, here to see... your boss."
The man opened the door wide.
"The magic word?" "What's that?"
"Severy, of course,"
he said, looking his visitor over with intense curiosity.
"The name gets batted around here a fair amount. I'm Cavett, by the way."
Philip followed Cavett as he turned down a familiar hallway leading to the back of the house.
"It's all last names here. Lyons likes it that way. Sorry about my appearance, but it's the weekend, and I don't normally answer the door. You can wait here."
They entered the expansive anteroom where Philip had waited during his previous visit. He frowned as he recalled how Nellie had sat there at the desk, no doubt pretending to work as she sized him up and tamed him with good food, all the while having him wait for a man she knew would never arrive.
"If I know Lyons," Cavett continued, "she won't keep you waiting long. Not this time."
Philip drifted toward the desk, inspecting with renewed eyes the framed photographs on the mantel shelf. Not of Nellie posing with her boss's clients, but of Nellie posing with her own. Cavett hesitated at the door.
"I hope you make the right choice, Severy."
Then he winked and withdrew. Philip walked the length of the room, stopping at the glass wall that framed ocean and sky. It looked as if it might rain, which added to the strange sinking feeling in his chest. As he watched the cloud cover descend on a colorless Pacific, the misery of his previous night came back to him. The twins having gone to a friend's house, he and Jane had endured a silent dinner together, with both of them drinking more than usual. But when little Drew emerged from her room in her PJs and asked, for the first time in a while, if Mommy and Daddy would be back for her soon, Jane had to flee the room for fear of breaking down. Philip had wrestled back his own torment until Faye swooped in to take Drew back to bed. He followed his wife outside, where she had fallen onto the grass.
"I can't stand it, Philip," she choked. "Where am I supposed to put all this?"
She thumped at her chest as if trying to dislodge something from her ribcage. He took her fist in his hand and whispered,
One day at a time, darling. We'll go on our hikes again like we used to.
Jane took back her fist and began to tug nervously at the lawn. The tugging became strangely methodical as she put her face to the ground to seek out anything that wasn't grass.
Maybe there's a better time for weeding, he gently suggested. But she didn't appear to hear him. So Philip just sat there and kept his wife company as she crawled along, sending fistfuls of weeds flying. He didn't dare turn to the house, where he sensed her sister watching from the doorway as if to say, "See?"
He thought again of this morning, of how Jane hadn't looked at him once, of how she was looking thinner and thinner every day. Of course she hadn't asked where he was going. She had completely lost interest in the world around her. The question was, how long was he going to watch her waste away? A thin mist accumulated on the window. Philip's mind was growing weary of all the gloom and began to seek out a reliable pleasure source. Anitka. Anya. He liked repeating her Russian diminutive over and over in his mind. Anya. But just when he had isolated the perfect image of her standing at the foot of her bed, dairy smooth skin, untying a black robe, an unwelcome voice invaded his fantasy.
You think yourself clever showing up in your own car.
He turned, searching for her, but the room was empty. Her voice issued from a hidden speaker somewhere.
You think this gives you some control over the situation, Mr. Severy?
There was the usual smile in her voice, betraying some secret delight.
No, no, he answered. You have all the control, Nellie. You've made that very clear.
The speaker sighed.
Why don't you come to me?
And where's that?
Go into my study.
He crossed the room and pushed open the double doors onto the faint smell of cigarette smoke. All the animal trophies were dim, except for the lioness, which cast a glow on the case containing the taser rifles. Nellie's voice leapt to a speaker at the desk.
The door in the corner. Walk through it. Turn right.
He was soon in a bright, functional hallway with a door at the far end. Her voice floated above him.
The door leads to a stairwell. Wait at the bottom.
He descended two flights of stairs.
How deep does this place go?
Until he was confronted with a pair of earmuffs and goggles hanging beside a metal door.
You'll want to put those on, she instructed.
He did as he was told, and on the other side of the door was a second door. He pushed it open and found Nellie standing with her back to him, head to foot in khaki, staring down the scope of a hunting rifle. She took aim at a rapidly moving target, a black cutout of an antelope. She fired into the antelope's flank with what looked to be real bullets and removed her earmuffs. He did the same.
Good of you to come, she said.
Her secretarial glasses had returned.
I'm guessing you're zoned for this.
Of course. I do have some influence.
Influence or money?
So, I'm just some rich eccentric, is that it? Throwing money around on private firing ranges?
It's what I thought when I assumed you were a man. Is there any reason to change my mind now?
She smiled, so wide that her irises nearly disappeared. Then she clicked on the rifle safety and held out the gun to him.
Care to perforate some cardboard?
He shook his head.
What happened to your taser rifle?
It doesn't give the same kick.
Heads up.
They shielded their ears, and she fired at the leaping silhouette, creating a blossom-shaped wound in its side. When it was gone, she tore off her muffs and dismantled the rifle. As she removed the magazine, she exhaled heavily, clearing the air for a new topic.
I won't make you guess my age, she began, opening a gun cabinet behind her. But my company has been an unofficial contractor of the U.S. government for nearly 30 years. Christ, you really are off the radar.
Some may question the legality of it, but no one ever questions the great deal of good we've done for this country. GSR makes a profit, of course. The Lyons estate could afford to subsidize this operation for only so long. But considering the enormous benefit we're offering our customers, the U.S. government being one, well, you can't put a proper price on that.
Besides, Lyons is an American above all. Even his cars, as you may have noticed, are domestic. She caught herself and laughed.
Listen to me, boasting about myself in the third-person male again.
Must get awfully confusing for you.
You can't imagine.
She locked the cabinet and led him farther down the hall. It took years of work to get to the point where I could even think about recruiting someone like you. You can guess how, as a 20-something, a girl, really, having just come into my inheritance and trying to build my own business, how few would look at me as anything other than a prospective intern or date. Even after I'd managed to get meetings with a few scientists at this or that university, they would take one look at me and have to smother a laugh. I had one guy, a very brilliant economist whom I'd admired for years, offer me a job as his secretary. He liked my attention to detail. I was furious, of course. But as soon as my head cleared, I decided to give these guys what they wanted. And for my next meeting, I went not as myself, but as my own assistant. I discovered that a few were willing to take me seriously if they believed I was working for a man. Same applied to all my meetings in D.C. They entered a small break room, outfitted with various appliances, including an espresso machine. "Cappuccino?" she asked.
"No, thank you.
I spent a salt mine on this contraption. You're having cappuccino." She switched on the machine and rummaged for grounds and milk. And so Nellie Stone was born. Mr. P. Booth Lyons's indispensable right hand. I assumed that I would shed the deception, of course, as soon as I got a solid foothold or no longer looked like I was 19. But as I discovered, once I had created this persona, it was hard to put her back in the box. And you could sustain all this for 30 years on a lie. Oh, it's a harmless lie, isn't it? And few ever questioned my story because I appeared so well informed that I simply must have been sent by someone important. As you pointed out, secrecy is part of my business model. So if anyone came at me with too many questions, I would plead confidentiality and trade secrets. Of course, my boss was always far too busy traveling to actually meet anyone in person, though when he was absolutely required, I would send Cavett or some other equally distinguished-looking person in my place. For some reason, I always imagined my fictional Lyons as this patriot, yet vaguely European in bearing and style. Or pretentious, Philip thought of saying but didn't. He was thinking of that ridiculous condolence letter she'd sent him. "The day I came up here," he said, "why bother with the whole ruse? What was the point of bringing me here if Mr. Lyons was never going to show?" She pursed her lips in an effort to contain her own amusement. "I knew that if I got you comfortable enough, I could find out whether you knew where your father's work was hidden. I could find out without Mr. Lyons ever having to arrive." "I told you I didn't know." "It was slippery of me, but you see, after a while, my twin identities have become second nature. In fact, I rather enjoy being Ms. Stone." She sighed wistfully as she tamped the espresso grounds. This was all so much easier pre-internet, of course. These days, everyone demands to know everything, instantly.
"Did my father know?"
She nodded. "He was one of the few I told who wasn't working directly for me. It was a risk, but I loved his work, and I trusted him. He, unfortunately, in the end, didn't trust me, and backed out of our agreement."
"By dying, you mean?"
"By betraying our understanding," she said coldly. "I do have a business to run." He shouted above the steaming milk.
"How can you be sure I'll keep your secret?"
"Doesn't matter. It's time for Miss Stone to retire. Besides, gone are the days when she could use her feminine charms to get what she wanted. That kind of cheap persuasion doesn't work for me like it once did." She poured the espresso and foam into two cups. "Funny. That may be the last time I tell that story to anyone.
I hope it clears everything up."
"Well, not everything." "We'll get to your father's work soon enough," she said, handing him his cappuccino. "What did you make of Cavett?" He looked down at his cup, at the Mandelbrot pattern she had fashioned in the foam.
"What about him?"
"I recruited him from the London School of Economics in the 90s, where he was doing some startling work on the fractal nature of African villages.
Before Cavett, no one had bothered to look at the architecture of these settlements from above. He realized that they are remarkably self-similar. The form of the entire village repeated in the form of the neighborhood, the block, the house.
I'm familiar with how fractals work.
She ignored him and continued. Turns out his research applied not only to villages in Africa, but also to settlements all over the world. If one knows what the outside of a town looks like, one can anticipate the interior. The military has been using Cavett's techniques in the Middle East for years, when soldiers enter areas without satellite images.
But fractals don't get you killed, Philip said. Guns and bombs do.
Exactly, she said with emphasis. Death is unexpected, isn't it, no matter how well we plan for it? Cavett's method is merely a tool, and where his methods end, your father's work begins. She signaled Philip back into the hallway. Drinks in hand, they clicked down the tile to another set of double doors, where Nellie turned to him with a barely suppressed smile. I guess I didn't realize how much I was looking forward to showing you this.
His mathematics, you mean?
She nodded. Can you think of anything more exhilarating than the realization that the future is, in fact, knowable? And with that, she pushed open the doors. Sometime later, Philip sat in a leather bucket chair, picking his way through figures on a wall. He was aware of Nellie breathing in the darkness beside him, her respirations loud enough to make him feel as if his own breathing had stopped. The equation was of some length, so long, in fact, that its projected image spilled from the wall onto the concrete floor. Was his heart still beating? He couldn't feel it. It was as if his body had gone into a kind of torpor, so that his brain alone could barrel ahead. It was a familiar sensation that he'd experienced the few times he had a particularly exhilarating idea in his own work. At such moments, he imagined that his brain was approaching the speed of light, while the variables in front of him slowed to a standstill. It might have been 5 minutes since Nellie had flicked on the projector, or it might have been 20. But he had needed only a few seconds to identify the equation as his father's. It bore all of the signature refinement, the dedication to the graceful, the spare, the clean-swept. But here and there, erupting out of tidy, almost unassuming passages, was a mathematics of such delight and strangeness that it seemed to Philip to be almost a new kind of logic, created elsewhere, extragalactically. As if Isaac Severy had been chosen to introduce this brand of math to Earth. Even if this equation meant nothing, even if it were just delirious ramblings, it was beautiful. But toward the end of the equation, something happened. The numbers took a sharp turn, as if rebelling, and the accompanying symbols seemed to stick out their Greek tongues. Had he missed something? Was this, in fact, over his head? Bewildered, Philip asked Nellie to scroll back to the beginning. She didn't seem to register his confusion. Lovely, isn't it? She asked in the same way she had asked about the lioness trophy in her office. Of course, she continued, I'm no mathematician. I had to have one of my guys explain the more arcane pieces. But then it was this feeling of exaltation, like a portal opening. Where did you say you found this? He asked casually. I didn't say. He must have hidden it well. Not as well as you'd think, she said. It was, however, password protected. It took nearly a week to crack. Let me guess. He left the password hidden in plain sight. A pause. How did you know? Because he can't help himself. It was a string of numbers, she explained, left encoded in a simple game of checkers. He smiled. Sounds about right. Turning back to the equation, Philip said, I would need more time, of course, to fully process this. You can sit here as long as you like. Memorize the thing if you want. I won't be able to give you a copy, you understand. Not until I agree to work for you. You must get tired of my conditions. Philip started to read the equation again from the beginning, but stopped when the symbols began to wag their tongues again. He closed his eyes. Was he really too dim to process this? Is that what it had come to? Brain rot. He could hear his father hissing. But that's not what was bothering him. Why had Isaac kept this beautiful math a secret from him?
Philip started to speak, but he knew that if he continued, he would start sobbing. Why not break down right there? Go ahead, curl up in this very expensive chair and cry like a goddamn infant. It seemed like the perfect response to his father's treachery, to his inability to share his work with his son, his favorite child.
Why hadn't he trusted him? Hadn't Philip shared everything with his father, told him absolutely everything that was going on in his head?
As he asked these questions, his mind conjured up Isaac's cruel response. Let's face it, Philip. It's been some time since you've produced good ideas in your own field. You didn't need the distraction. You may have been remarkable once, but...
Remarkable. There was that word again.
A squeak of impatience from Nellie's chair.
Did you say something?
I was thinking. Philip managed dispassionately. This could be a lot of lovely nothing. She pulled her chair close.
Let's just assume for a second it is something. And if it were something, what might that be?
It's not a traffic equation.
No? How can you tell?
From the bits I've seen of my father's traffic project, the math is different.
It's difficult to explain.
Then what is it?
You already know, or you wouldn't be swaggering around like you've won a prize.
Say it, Philip. Say what it is.
The glow from the projection made her eyes almost manic. He had to look away. It's a predictive equation.
Don't be vague. What kind?
Somehow Philip had known what kind of equation it was the moment she had switched on the projector. Perhaps for the past week his subconscious had been working on the problem of his father's obsessive newspaper collection. Isaac had accumulated those clippings for decades, yet the stockpile never found its way into his mathematics, at least not publicly.
But Philip knew his father enough to see that he wouldn't have wasted his time on such a collection had it not held the possibility of a greater purpose.
An end point. Isaac Severy had been preoccupied with death to the extreme. It's a death oracle, or so you're hoping, he said. You may as well name it something fancy.
You're still being vague.
A sharp chill ran up his back. All those clippings had been of fatal accidents, but the ones his father had flagged in Sharpie had been particularly suspicious. A woman whose car brakes failed. An abusive father trapped in a discarded refrigerator while his family was away. A man who accidentally shot his fiancée while cleaning his gun. It hadn't been mundane accidents that had fascinated his father, but instead the blurred line between chance and vicious intent, between a genuine accident and a perceived one. This was what Isaac had been attempting to isolate.
It's more than just death, Philip said at last. The math indicates intent.
He could sense Nellie beaming beside him, willing him to continue. Homicide prediction in the greater L.A. area.
Can you believe you just said that?
She sounded as if she were about to yank him out of his chair and waltz him around the room.
To think what we could have done with this years ago. Can you imagine how it would have been one fateful morning in September to see a map of Manhattan's financial district light up? Or that field in Pennsylvania? Or London? Madrid? What about the Paris attacks 2 days ago?
If such an equation were possible.
If? Open your eyes.
Whatever it is, he said, it's clearly about control.
How do you mean?
It's my father's attempt to control the uncontrollable, or at least predict it. As if that could have saved my brother somehow, he stopped himself. Not because he didn't want to discuss his family history with Nellie, but because he wasn't sure that Isaac's motivations had anything to do with saving lives. As with most everything in his father's career, hadn't he done it for the thrill of discovery? Isn't that why Philip had chosen theoretical physics? How he wished his father could have shared the math that lay in front of him now, explained to him its wonders and nuances. But Philip had been robbed of that. He fought back against a renewed wave of anger and grief. The best intentions are born out of strife, Philip.
Nellie leaned back in her chair.
Why do you think I built this company?
Because I'm an innately ambitious person, or because I feel compelled to correct some intolerable imbalance from my past?
I wouldn't attempt to understand your motives, Nellie, but I promise to read your memoirs.
You ready to move on?
She asked.
With a click of a button, the numbers vanished along with their wagging tongues, and in their place appeared a map of Los Angeles County, perforated with colored dots. Each one held a string of numbers. Time code.
You created this from the equation?
Oh no, we're not that far along yet. Your father left this for us. A gift.
For you to steal.
For us to find, she corrected him. The dots are for the month of November. They stop after that. The green ones have been confirmed by us. Blue, unconfirmed.
And you're saying this actually works?
As Philip heard himself pose this question, he could suddenly see a terrible future spinning out before him, one in which control and certainty ruled every aspect of their lives. He shuddered.
It works exceedingly better than the LAPD's medieval attempts at crime forecasting. We still have work to do, of course. And the red.
He silently counted 9 red dots. Those are happening today.
How are you verifying these?
Police scanners, blotters, internet, newspapers. But often we need to verify them on the scene.
That's when I send someone.
I believe you know him.
Someone I know is working on this?
She smiled. When you join us, I will happily reveal his identity. He shifted in his chair, checking his mental Rolodex for a possible traitor. Nellie flicked a laser pen at points around the city. The Whittier dot has a time code of early this morning, and Culver City, she glanced at her phone, 20 minutes ago, which, incidentally, my guy has just confirmed. A domestic murder. Very sad. Philip stared, stunned by her nonchalance.
If these dots are accurate, if people are going to die, why not do something about it?
What do you suggest we do? Run around the city playing superhero?
Why not?
Don't be funny. Nellie clicked off her laser pen. Our task now is to verify the equation's power and limits. Only then can we begin to decide what to do with the information. Philip squinted at the map, straining to read the dots.
Tell that to the person who's going to die downtown this evening, or the one this afternoon in the Angeles National Forest.
I should add, she said, ignoring his last remark, that your father distinguished murders from homicides. All murders are homicides, but not necessarily the reverse. Murder requires intent, of course, while homicides can include involuntary manslaughter. Drunk driving, for instance, doesn't figure into Isaac's equation. In the end, it really comes down to intent.
And suicides?
Ah, she said. In order to create a true murder map, your father tried his best to cancel them out. Not that a suicide map wouldn't be useful on its own, but he wanted the option to filter them. Unfortunately, he never got to it.
So his equation can't tell the difference.
Nellie shook her head. When it comes to a distinction between the two, the equation is blind. She peered at the map. But then suicide is murder, isn't it? It's in the etymology of the word, after all. He frowned.
Then this means that my father's own...
Yes, she said. For the first time that day, he detected something in her voice that sounded close to regret. It means that Isaac's own death was predicted by the equation. Philip was silent for a moment as he tried to reconcile all he knew of his father and his apparent suicide, with this new information. Just as an unsettling scenario opened up before him, his phone vibrated in his pocket. He saw that he had somehow missed 3 calls, one from the house, and 2 from his sister-in-law's cell phone. Something the matter? Nellie asked. He stood up.
I need to make a call.
A minute later, he was back upstairs in her study. As he headed past the lioness, he couldn't help but glance again at the rifle case. He'd always had a visceral reaction to guns, but at that moment they held a particular dread, or a kind of warning. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Philip pulled his eyes from the weapons and left the room. In the waiting area, he hunted for a signal. He found a couple of bars near the window, and as he looked out over the water, the sky threatening rain, he dialed Faye. She picked up immediately.
"Is Jane with you? Why would she be with me?" he asked.
"It's just that after dropping the twins off at their lesson, she never came back. We were supposed to go to yoga an hour ago. She's not picking up her phone."
"Did you two fight?"
A sigh. "She said I was smothering her, but it's nothing she hasn't said before."
"Maybe she's at her therapist."
"No, that was yesterday. I didn't want to panic you, but..."
"Start looking."
"I don't have the car."
"Do what you can, Faye. I'm coming home."
He hung up. After trying Jane several times and getting no answer, Philip went to the front door to leave. He was met by Cavett, who stood there like a butler, in shoes this time.
"Leaving without goodbye. Something's come up."
As Cavett opened the door, he simultaneously passed Philip a square envelope, stamped with the brain spiral.
"She was afraid you'd run off before she had a chance to give you the details of the offer. It's all there."
Cavett slapped a chummy hand on his back.
"I'm looking forward to working with a Severy."
Without a reply, Philip slipped the envelope into his pocket and left. He knew what he needed to do. He needed to drive quickly toward that red dot on the border of the Angeles National Forest. It seemed an odd place for a murder, at the very edge of the park, south of Mount Wilson. A tiny circle nestled just inside the green expanse. Eaton Canyon. Yes, he was sure of it now. That familiar twist of trail that he and Jane knew so well. The time code had read November 15th, and then, he closed his eyes, summoning the rest. 17, 11, 26. 5:11 p.m. and 26 seconds. He checked his watch. That was 90 minutes from now. Starting the car, Philip remembered with growing alarm the discussion he'd last had with his wife in the canyon. He floored the gas and drove as fast as he dared down the hill, casting a swift, paranoid glance in the rearview mirror to make sure Nellie wasn't having him tailed. When he pulled onto the Pacific Coast Highway, his chest was pounding, and soon the pounding beneath his ribs was echoed by a far-off drumbeat in his brain. Chapter 23. The Station. Hazel parked the Cadillac in Chinatown and proceeded to Union Station on foot, arriving 35 minutes ahead of the time indicated on the map. It wasn't until she neared the station entrance that she realized there was more at stake here than just finding Alex. Someone, presumably, was going to die in a half hour. She wondered if an anonymous tip to the police might be in order, but what would she say? Instead, she called her brother. She was now ready to spill everything to Gregory in one long breath, no longer caring that Isaac had warned her not to. But he didn't pick up. Considering the condition she'd seen him in yesterday, this didn't exactly surprise her. Could he be embarrassed? Hazel left a message asking him to call her, that it was urgent. She paused to look up at the clock tower, 9:10. The tower was a familiar sight from childhood trips to the station. Her transportation-obsessed grandfather had considered such visits an essential part of her and Gregory's education. But aside from a few novelty train rides, Hazel had rarely taken the railroad as an adult. A pity, because she had always been a sucker for the majesty of the place. While the building's Mission Revival exterior informed passers-by that they were squarely in the Southwest, the interior's deco-type faces and streamlined modern embellishments ushered commuters through the modern age of travel, stylishly directing them to railway platforms, ticket sales, and baggage claim. As she passed beneath the sentinel palms on either side of the arched entrance, she wished for a moment that she had a valise dangling from one hand and a first-class sleeper ticket in the other. The urge to disappear was overpowering. As this romantic notion subsided, an image of Alex rushed to take its place. Hazel's ears burned with humiliation and anger at the idea of seeing him. Then again, there were dots all over the city. She could see only a fragment of the map on her phone, and he could very well be in Inglewood or Compton or Carson, or wherever else people die. Or, more precisely, where they are murdered. Isn't that what Raspanti had been trying to tell her? Ordinarily, Union Station would have been deserted that time of night, with only a few desultory travelers among the rows of imitation leather chairs, or an odd commuter catching a local back to Pasadena or North Hollywood. But the station was remarkably lively. A wedding party had rented out the now-defunct ticketing area, an enormous room off the lobby. The space featured a row of intimidating oak counters designed to imbue the act of buying a train ticket with the gravity of going to a bank. The wedding, which was evidently old Hollywood-themed, was entering its phase of sloppy abandon. The female guests shrieked and shimmied in their bias-cut dresses, and heavy-lidded men with martini glasses and vape pens leaned on ticket counters. Hazel hesitated at the information booth, entranced momentarily by the beauty of the celebration. She turned and followed a glamorous couple across the marble floor and past the station's cocktail lounge, which was filled with the moody, antisocial spillover from the wedding. Her breath stopped when she spotted Alex sitting among a clutch of tables just outside the bar. He wore a wrinkled blazer and was nursing a bright red cocktail. He stared at her, a quizzical expression on his face. She strode in his direction, trying her best to appear as if she knew what she was doing, as if she had a plan. He spoke first. "Can I get you a drink?" She pulled out a chair but didn't sit. "Whatever you're having is fine," she said coldly. But there was a tremor in her voice. He glanced around for the waiter. "You shouldn't be here, you know. It's not safe."
"Oh, really? Why's that?"
"After this drink, you should leave. I mean it, Hazel." There was an arrogance in the way he held up his hand for the waiter's attention. She had gotten Alex all wrong, of course. She had mistaken him for one of her own kind. A geek. All rumpled clothes and bashful witticisms. A romantic at heart who was just waiting for the right person to come along. But now she saw him as a much odder creature. A disheveled playboy who could toy easily with women's hearts, because his true love was mathematics. Math may have betrayed him years ago, may have given up her secrets to another man, but he still pined for her. And no one would ever measure up. "Another Campari and soda, please," he told the passing waiter. "Make that too."
"How international of you," Hazel said. "You pick that up in Europe?"
He turned back to her. His gaze was intense. "From my mother, actually. She's an alcoholic." Hazel sat down, locking her eyes on his.
"I found your wig and mustache."
"Oh, did I leave them somewhere?" He made a show of checking his pockets.
"I assume you also erased the photos on my phone. When did you manage that? When I was answering the door?"
Alex finished what was left in his glass. "All right, I give up. If I erase the photos, how are you here?" She was furious with him, but she couldn't help return some of his coolness.
"I'm here for the party."
He smiled. "Bride side or groom's?" Their drinks arrived before she could craft a response.
"Do you think the event will happen here?"
she asked. He adjusted himself on his chair. "I know as much about it as you do." That's when she noticed a camera around his neck, a Leica, half hidden by his jacket.
"What's that for?"
"Documentation." She glanced at the nearest deco clock, which read 9:07.
"Shouldn't we be calling the police or something?"
"And what do you suggest we tell them?"
"You don't understand, officer. It's mathematics."
Alex laughed into his drink.
"I'm sure we could come up with something smarter than that."
He shook his head. "No police. We need the system to play out without interference."
"So these people, they're just a mathematical system to you? You just observe, snap your picture, and walk away?"
He leaned across the table. "Actually, you're making my job as disinterested observer more difficult. See, in this system here," he indicated the station with a wave of his hand, "you and I are the contamination."
"But you just interacted with a waiter."
"Hey, I can't remove myself from the system entirely. Plus, this is one of the few events, as you say, where one can get a drink."
"You've witnessed others, then?"
He nodded.
There were a couple of nasty ones on the east side 2 days ago. Gang-related. I watched from a safe enough distance with a long lens. I have yet to figure out if Isaac's calculations are total in their omniscience, but I need to be sure that I am not, even as a witness, part of the system somehow. Then again, it's likely someone dies no matter what we do. Even if we try to stop it, we can't cheat the inevitable.
So the math somehow knows we're here? Has already figured that in?
Yes. It could be that the equation is, in fact, aware of itself.
Hazel took this in. The idea that the equation knew, that the universe knew, what she would do before she did it, made her head ache. It was as if someone had just told her that every second of her life had been monitored on surveillance tape. She forced herself to look at the clock again. 15 minutes now. She needed to get to the point.
So, did you crack the password?
With some help. He looked up at her quickly, realizing what he had just said. Was Alex working for someone? Could Rasponti be right about this they?
Operating on the assumption that you find out more when you appear to know the answer already, she asked,
Are you at least expensing the drinks to the people you work for?
The people I work for. Where'd you pick up that phrase?
She quickly changed tacks. Okay, did you steal the equation for your own benefit? Because some Russian beat you to your precious proof, and now it's your turn to take the credit you so deserve?
Alex blanched. You've been speaking to my mother.
She's pretty chatty when you corner her.
God, does she love that story. The story of my epic failure. He took a long drink and said, I don't steal other people's mathematics.
What do you call breaking into Isaac's hotel room or ransacking his office? On the day of the funeral, that was you in his study, wasn't it?
He smiled tightly. His work doesn't belong to you, Hazel. You wouldn't have a clue what to do with it. Isn't that why you let me in the room in the first place?
It doesn't belong to you either.
Alex was about to take another drink, but stopped. It hardly matters. The equation doesn't work. She sat back in her chair.
I don't understand.
It doesn't work.
You wouldn't be here if it didn't.
The equation is junk, Hazel. The map is a tease. Isaac left behind just enough information to suggest the real thing. Sure, the map's predictions are accurate. Isaac's own death, numerous violent deaths around the city. But the dots stop. Union Station is one of the last. Do you know what Isaac left on that computer?
How would I know?
A phony equation. Trompe-l'oeil math. Get up close and it completely loses its dimension. Beautiful, sure, and real enough to fool most people. But not me.
She wondered if Alex was making this up to get rid of her.
But if the map works, she reasoned, the real math behind it must be somewhere.
Yes, but where?
You were obviously the decoy.
She shook her head. Isaac wouldn't do that to me, she said, trying to swallow back a tightness in her throat. He wouldn't make me go through all this trouble just to throw somebody off the trail.
Are you sure about that? The password was numerical, by the way, hidden in that silly game of checkers that was staring at us all night, designed for someone like me to solve.
She looked away, thinking of her grandfather's letter, of the riddles he had crafted just for her. But she would never have decoded a checkers game. So Isaac didn't trust her after all?
Was that the ultimate answer to the riddle? Ha ha, you thought I meant you?
She laughed sadly.
So, I'm just a sucker, is that it? Played not only by you, but also by my own grandfather?
It stung to say these things out loud.
I didn't play you, Hazel.
No?
She could feel her face getting hot. You bait me at the Halloween party. You manipulate your way into the hotel room.
She cursed her quavering voice, but continued.
You play the adoring Isaac fan, the poor little rich orphan abandoned by his parents, all the while biding your time until you could steal what you wanted.
Alex closed his eyes briefly.
I won't deny that I took what didn't belong to me.
He leaned across the table. But you have to understand. I never hid the fact that I wanted to see the equation. I didn't hide that I've had a less than ideal childhood,
and that I've clung to Isaac and his work as a result. I didn't hide that I was hoping to draw somebody out, somebody who had the information I wanted. I was glad that person was you. But now I'm sorry it was.
Hazel listened, not wanting to believe any of what he said, but also knowing that he no longer had any reason to lie to her. Hadn't he gotten what he'd been after? Even if it ended up being a fake? She thought back to the moment she had first seen him at the funeral, the awkward academic at the podium.
That equation you read out loud, she said.
What was that?
It's exactly what I said it was, Hazel. A scrap of his math I found long ago.
He leaned back, his voice dropping dramatically, but his eyes still fixed on hers.
I thought someone might recognize it. If it turned out to be a piece of the equation I was looking for, I figured I could get a reaction from the person who had the rest.
He was talking so quietly now that Hazel had to lean forward to hear him.
But the scrap was just that, a scrap of nothing, and all I ended up doing was looking like a fool.
I can barely hear you. Why are you talking so softly?
Because, he said, I want your face nearer to mine.
Alex leaned across the table and eyes zeroed in on her mouth, kissed her. Her immediate impulse was to pull away, but when she didn't, when she realized that she'd wanted this since the first time she saw him, a heady current surged through her. After a few seconds, she sat back in her seat.
What was that for?
For the hallway, at the hotel, when I wanted to kiss you but couldn't because I knew I was about to betray you.
I wish you'd pick the kiss.
I really wanted to, Hazel. Her face and neck still burned with the memory of his lips on hers. She wondered if they might do it again. But Alex set his chin in his palm and just looked at her, his eyes taking her in. There was, in fact, a look of regret in his face, mixed with something else. Admiration? Adoration? It wasn't conspicuous, as if he were trying to convince her of it, but buried, mingled with other emotions and loyalties that were bearing down on him. The arrogance she thought she had detected earlier had disappeared, as had her own anger. She wondered where this left them, if anywhere. Was the kiss a one-time thing, or might they do a great deal of it in the future? Alex's expression suggested the latter, but then his brow transformed rapidly into a frown. He appeared to be focusing on something just past her shoulder.
What is it? She asked.
Did you tell anyone you were here?
No.
No one?
Why?
Hazel turned. On the other side of the lobby, a man in sunglasses and a threadbare jacket, who clearly wasn't here for any wedding, was walking unevenly in the direction of the trains. He appeared to have a limp. Not far behind the man, walking more purposefully, was her brother. Hazel didn't call out, but just stared. Her hand involuntarily sought Alex's. There was something strange about Gregory, something she had noticed to a lesser degree since Sybil's death, but hadn't been able to name. It was as if she were suddenly looking at a person whose body bore the outward shape of a man, but had left the sad, wronged child inside, peering out the husk of adulthood. Chapter 24. The Canyon. Philip drove as quickly as traffic would permit back to Pasadena, where just north of the city, 200 acres of hiking trails and steep gorges carved themselves into the foothills of the San Gabriel Mountains. In the early days of their marriage, when funds had been tight and entertainment options limited, Eaton Canyon had been a frequent destination for him and Jane. Aside from a shared love of science, being out in the open space of the natural world had always united them. But after a wildfire in the 1990s destroyed much of the canyon's beauty, their hiking tapered off, and in recent years they had enjoyed the park separately, Jane in order to maintain her daily runner's high, and Philip to walk off a particularly stubborn piece of physics. It was only their daughter's death that had brought them there together in recent days. As Philip slowed near the sign for the Eaton Canyon Nature Center,
he saw what he'd been hoping not to see. Jane's green Nissan Pathfinder, parked on the road several yards from the park's entrance.